Welcome to The Art Scene, presented each week by UA Little Rock Public Radio. I'm Daniel Breen, in for Ann Nicholson. After 20 years of heading the Buffalo Philharmonic, Grammy-winning conductor Joanne Folletta makes her first trip to Arkansas to kick off the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra's 2019-2020 season. Her work as a trailblazing conductor has earned her the title of 2019 Woman of the Year by Performance Today. Today, Folletta takes us on a trip to the Islamic Golden Age with a slight detour in 19th century Russia. Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade has become a classical staple since its debut in 1888, telling the vibrant tales of the 1001 Nights through vibrant, colorful orchestration. Folletta spoke with The Art Scene about her love of Rimsky's work, as well as modern composers like Jennifer Higdon, whose concerto is paired with Scheherazade for the symphony's inaugural concert of the season. Folletta also spoke about her roots as a classical guitarist and some unexpected sides of conducting the audience might not necessarily see.
I was really a double major for most of my educational life. I'm a classical guitarist, but I fell in love with conducting, so I studied both at the Mannes College of Music in New York and then at Juilliard. And now travel a lot, and I've worked in different places, but I feel very lucky to have had the chance to study in those schools and to have had great teachers.
I did want to ask about the sort of connection between conducting an orchestra and playing the classical guitar. I think maybe it was Segovia or someone who said that the guitar is sort of like an orchestra within itself, where you can make all the different sounds that an orchestra makes. Did that propel your thinking to conduct?
In a way it did, you know, and he was right. I mean, and he played in such a way that you could actually hear the different colors of an orchestra in his playing. It was so fabulous. But for me, the two complement each other very beautifully, because conducting an orchestra is very public. You're dealing with maybe 75 or 80 people or more, or at all times, and it's, you know, very active. Guitar is very private and personal for the most part, where you practice alone, and you try and create all those orchestral colors yourself on the guitar. So it's been a beautiful combination for me, and I feel since I started my musical life as a classical guitarist, I never want to give that up, but frankly, I spend most of my time conducting now.
I was wondering about sort of that aspect of people managing people and being sort of the leader instead of, you know, just strictly focusing on the music. Was that something you had to get used to?
Yes, and you are very perceptive. That's something they never teach you in school, but when you're a conductor, you're dealing with a very talented group of people. You're dealing with an amazing team. I think it's the greatest team in the world. The Symphony Orchestra's greatest team. So you have to realize that everyone has their strong feelings about how the piece should go and what tempo it should be. But somehow we come together in a unified interpretation, and the conductor is sort of the catalyst of that. I mean, I have to, as a conductor, establish a landscape where everyone can be comfortable and can be the excellent musicians they are. That's really my role. It's not to make music. It's not to create a sound, but it's to enable them to be great. But it is an interesting team, I have to tell you. I mean, I love that. I love that kind of talent around me. I mean, the level of experience is amazing, the talent, the individuality, the characters that are in every orchestra, you know, their different personalities. And that's really what part of what makes the job so much fun.
Yeah, I feel like if I were put in your situation where you're forced to know every little detail about a piece, I would sort of have a hard time taking notes from the musicians, even though, you know, they're at the top of their professional game and they have their own thoughts and everything. I'm just wondering how much of that is your day-to-day interaction with them. Are you receiving input on the piece from them?
I constantly receive input, but not in the way you're thinking. They don't say anything. They usually don't give notes. But in the way they play, they're telling me a lot of what I need to know. If they are feeling completely comfortable and completely free, in a way, then they can play at their best. I can tell if they're feeling constrained or the tempo's not really working or it's just an awkward approach to something or I'm not giving them enough time to play the solo. I can tell by the sound of how they're playing. I try and adjust what I'm doing. So a lot of it is not actually speaking, but listening to them. And I feel, and I think every conductor should probably feel this, that our greatest teachers are the musicians. They're the ones who teach us how to make music, because they are the experts. You just said that. They're the complete experts in their instrument, and they focus on that. And the fact that the conductor is not playing an instrument in that moment allows us to listen, just to keep our ears open and listen. And again, take cues from the orchestra, which is the beautiful individuality of each concert.
In your place in your career right now, what is your sort of routine to approaching working with a new orchestra, playing perhaps a new piece?
It's very exciting for me because although I usually find I probably know a handful of people from either summer festivals or going to school together or something like this, usually it's new. I think in this case with the Orchestral Symphony, I'll be really meeting a lot of people I don't know. And my strategy with that is to always play a little bit, just play a little bit at the beginning, so they can get to know my way of moving around, I guess, most of all, and I can get to know their way of playing. So I can feel something about them, their character, and letting them play, because orchestras, this is what they do best. They do best when they're just playing, not when the conductor is stopping them every minute. They just play. So that's our sort of getting to know each other. And then I'll go back, like probably tonight what we'll do is read through the first movement of Rimsky-Korsakov Scheherazade, and then we'll go back and work on it. But my goal is to make it their performance, because that's what's interesting for me, to not try and come with a cookie cutter and say it has to sound exactly like 3 months ago with somebody else. No, it's they inform it. They bring their sound, their skills, their concept of it, and I like to allow room for that so that we feel we did something together that was maybe unrepeatable and completely unique in that moment.
Is there anything specifically that you look to yourself to do to bring something new to a performance that you might have already to a piece of music you might have already performed with another symphony, as opposed to looking to the musician solely?
Well, when I'm studying a piece of music, even if I've done it a lot, I always study it in great detail beforehand, and I always find something new. It's such an amazing thing about being a conductor is that you never really come to the end of the journey. You just keep learning. You keep developing. So always looking at the score reveals some things to me that I'm going to bring to this performance. Maybe I made a few tempo changes in my mind, thinking about what I did before. So it will be new for me, too. And I will remain flexible, because a lot of it, what I'm going to change, depends a little bit on their input and their approach to it.
Tell us about Rimsky-Korsakov and Scheherazade. This is it's a beautiful piece, but I think maybe not too well known outside of the classical music world.
Maybe it's one of those pieces that people hear a little bit of and say, oh, I heard that before. It is an unbelievable masterpiece. And Rimsky was one of the greatest composers for knowing how to write for orchestra. And like a great painter knows how to mix colors, well, Rimsky did exactly that. He was able to mix all the instruments together and make them shine. But the story is a wonderful one. It's based upon the 1001 Nights, which is an ancient book, but in the 18th century was finally translated into French. So from that point on, Europeans started to read this. Everyone was reading these stories, and they were fabulous. We know the stories today, Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves, and you know the magic carpet, and the genie coming out of the bottle, and all of that. These are wonderful stories. So when Rimsky read that, he said, "That's it. I'm going to write a story about this." The main character is this very young girl, Scheherazade. Perhaps she's 16 or 17 years old, and her country, Persia, is in a terrible, terrible situation because the Shah has been deceived by his wife, and he now trusts no women at all, and he's very angry, and he's enacting a terrible revenge. He's marrying young women and killing them the next morning. So, of course, the kingdom is in a state of mourning, and the chief, his prime minister, I guess, his chief assistant, is responsible for finding these young women that he can marry and then kill. And it's going on, and finally, Scheherazade, who is the daughter of the prime minister, comes to him and says, "Father, let me be the next one." No, of course you can imagine he said no probably 400 times. But she said, no, please, we can't go on like this. I think I found a way to change this. And so finally, he's just so overwhelmed with this tragedy. He says, okay, we'll try it. And I'm sure he was in great despair. But she marries the Shah. And she starts to tell him stories. And these are the stories that made up the book, 1001 Nights. And she's always very careful. These stories are fantastically colorful. And she's careful with two things. she always stops at the most exciting part and says, well, it's so late. My husband, I'll continue tomorrow. And he probably said the first night, all right, one more night. What does it matter? She weaves him into the story. So he's almost always the hero in some way. And he's very intrigued by this. So one night turns into 1,001 nights of storytelling. And in the meantime, she has 3 children. So at a certain point, and this happens in the last movement, he realizes that he's completely in love with her and he can't even imagine a life without her. And he is changed. He's changed. He's forgotten his anger. He's forgotten his vendetta. He's become a kind ruler. So it's a beautiful story in a way. And it also casts, which was very unusual for the time and the plays, a young woman as the hero, which was very unusual. So we hear all of that in this music. And we also hear Rimsky-Korsakov's love of the sea. Rimsky was a sailor in his young life, and he always loved the sea. So the big story of the sea and Sinbad's ship surrounds this. We hear it right at the beginning. You hear that music, and you know, I am on a ship. I mean, he creates this feeling that you could almost feel the ship going back and forth. And at the end, the ship plays a major role when it finally crashes up against a rock and disintegrates. And at that moment, Rimsky did a very unusual thing. He wrote in the score, right at the moment that the ship breaks apart, he wrote in Russian, the ship breaks apart on the rocks. The Sultan's heart breaks open with love. I'm very unusual for any composer to write in a score, but that's the story. He wanted everyone to know, okay, this is the moment when he realizes I'm changed. So it's filled with beautiful melodies, and highly romantic, very colorful, a piece that I've always loved, and I hope people will enjoy it too. I should say that the character of Scheherazade is played by the concertmaster. Your fantastic concertmaster will be the voice of Scheherazade every time he plays his solo. That will be her speaking, starting off with Once Upon a Time or continuing the story throughout the entire piece.
Yeah, I was going to ask who are the voices of the main characters. So
it's mostly the one that you'll hear the prince and the princess in the third movement. They are portrayed maybe by the clarinet and the strings, but the main character is the concertmaster, and it's one of the greatest violin solos in our entire repertoire. And you have a great concertmaster.
Oh,
so.
Yeah, of course.
Yes.
And you were mentioning the note that Rimsky left about the crashing of the ships. Yeah. I mean, that's obviously not something you see every day, but is that typical to have such a great source material that's based on the story that sort of lends itself to music like that?
This is one of the best, I have to say. A lot of music is programmatic. It's based on stories, a lot of it. But Rimsky must have truly loved this story. And it was, 1001 Nights was a book that everyone talked about. I mean, once it was translated, they could read it. They loved the stories, partly because in the end, the little person wins. I mean, in all of these stories, and you might think about the Disney versions, in the end of the stories, usually it's a little person, not a great ruler or a great king, who somehow finds his way to success. And for people in the 18th century, that was a wonderful thing to read about, you know, and the stories are funny sometimes, and they're filled with magic. What better than magic, you know? So yes, this is one of the best, and Rimsky obviously adored it.
That sense of magic, sort of when you're working with something that isn't so, impressionistic or just so obviously beautiful, when you're doing something more abstract, maybe like if you're conducting a Philip Glass opera or something, mm-hmm. how are you capturing that same magic or making sure that the audience is hearing it, I guess?
Yeah, that's sometimes a little bit more challenging because there is not a defined story, but there's always a sense of storytelling nonetheless, because playing a piece of music is a little bit like reading a book where at the beginning you go into it, maybe a little tentatively, you're not sure, and then it gets exciting. It has a climax somewhere, and then there's the denouement where it comes to an end, and it's right. You know, if we read a book and we say, that book was great, usually it's because it works that way. You know, it builds us up to something, even when we're not sure what's going to happen, and then it resolves it. We don't know what it is with a lot of music, and that's okay. And I always say to the audience, use your own imagination. And they do. Sometimes it's better not to have a defined story, and the people in the audience can just let images pass through their mind, thoughts pass through their minds, with the feeling that something is happening, and it's exciting, and it's right at the end. So that's a very good question, because what we call this abstract music that doesn't have defined words or defined story still has a story.
To that end, is there any music that you, I guess, shy away from, perhaps not professionally, but maybe some certain type of music that you don't like listening to personally?
No, you know, I love to listen to any kind of music. I love to conduct almost every kind of music. I mean, the thing I do the least is probably Baroque music, because when you have a big orchestra and you're dealing with 85, 90 people, you don't do that as much. But you know, all the way from Bach and Mozart all the way up to 21st century music. I'm so proud on this program. We have a piece that was premiered in 2008. So this is for Time for Three. It was fantastic. So that's really new music.
Could you talk a little bit about that? I'm unfamiliar with that.
Yeah, this is by Jennifer Higdon. Jennifer Higdon is one of our country's leading composers. And I'm saying leading composers. I didn't say leading women composers. She's leading composers.
They're composers.
Yes, yeah. They are composers. She is a superstar. Born in Atlanta and raised in Tennessee. I think she lives in Philadelphia now, but she works all over the world. And she wrote a wonderful triple concerto for one of the most fun groups I've ever worked with, a group called Time for Three. Renan Meyer, Nick Kendall, and Charles Yang. They are sort of, you know, pushing music a little bit into 21st century, you know, where it doesn't have to be quite as serious and, you know, kind of, you know, well-dressed as we normally think of classical music. They are fantastically talented, two violinists and a bass player. And she wrote this piece for them, it's called Concerto for Three. The three of them are the soloists, and it's about the rivers in Tennessee. Just beautiful. I mean, again, no specific story, but each movement is about a different river and, you know, a different, like the last one is about the raging rapids, and you can hear that. It's dangerous, she says. The middle movement is about a very quiet river in Tennessee. So it does have its own story, and that's 2008. So we're still telling stories in music.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Do we get any ships crashing in the rivers?
No, but it really goes at breakneck speed, this last movement, and it could. I mean, a disaster could happen. But it's totally fun working with them, and I'm just so glad to have the chance again. And this might be their first time with the Arkansas Symphony, I think.
Well, that does sort of lead me to ask you, what, as someone who has dedicated their life to classical music and whose job it is to ensure that it's heard, essentially, what is your, how do you hope that it's received, I guess, or what place do you think it should occupy in the public eye?
You know, I think it should be a natural part of people's lives, because it's their heritage. It belongs to them. And that they should enjoy it without fear. Sometimes people tell me, I'm not sure I should go to a concert because I never took a music class. Oh, not necessary at all. Only being a human being is necessary. Just come in and you'll be amazed. And I'm always thrilled that people who come for the first time come back and tell me, you know, I didn't think I was going to like it, but it was so thrilling. It was so dramatic to see the musicians playing, to hear the sound right around me live in the hall, to see them moving and obviously enjoying this music, to watch the soloists play things I could never even imagine anybody playing. This was one of the best 2 hours of my life. So it just takes that step in to see how exciting a concert can be. And we love playing for people who are there, and no experience necessary, just come. In fact, hearing Scheherazade is probably a wonderful way, and hearing the piece with Time for Three, a wonderful way to have your first classical concert experience.
Yeah, I wonder how much, when you're deciding what to program, you know, for the Buffalo Philharmonic mm-hmm. that you conduct, when you're making those programming decisions, how much of that is, will this be accessible, will people not be intimidated by it, like
right.
you said.
A lot of it is. But we understand that we're also introducing people to new things, like Jennifer Higdon. People may say, I never heard of Jennifer Higdon. I know Beethoven, but Jennifer Higdon. But take a chance, because Jen Higdon is very exciting. So we try and mix it up. I guess that's the best way of putting it. We try and have something for everyone on the program and have them be able to feel that, wow, this is a great thing for me. Whether you're, you know, 10 years old or 90 years old, that this is something that touched you as a human being. I always say that people come into the concert at 7:30 at night and they're, you know, they've got a lot on their mind, as everybody does, about the day, what happened at work, or what's going on with their kids, and they feel a certain way, and then 2 hours later, something has shifted inside. They feel differently. Because we're hardwired for music. Music speaks to us. It helps us relax. It helps us be in touch with ourselves. So when they walk out at 9:30, it's with a feeling like, wow, I feel good. And that's what music should do.
When you think of that feeling, do you, when you're trying to craft that yourself, do you take more inspiration, would you say, from composers, or maybe from just the musicians that you're working with, or other conductors, anyone?
I think it's a little bit of everything. Music that you know yourself, music that you discover through other people. It's always a mix, and it's always changing. It's always changing. So this weekend, I think it's a very good mix with Ravel and the Rimsky-Korsakov, and of course Jen's new piece, and three very different pieces, but dramatic music, exciting music, and music that's going to show off the Arkansas Symphony, because the Rimsky especially is filled with solos.
As a classical guitarist, do you wish you could just do all classical guitar featured concerts, you know, when you're programming things?
Well, I do program a lot of classical guitar. In fact, in Buffalo, we have a classical guitar competition. So we have guitarists on our stage all the time, because it's geared towards guitar concertos, like the famous Rodrigo Concierto de Aranjuez. And so we have guitarists from all over the world coming. And my hope is that it will even increase people's love of the classical guitar. And the wonderful thing about guitar is that it does cross a lot of boundaries, because when we have guitar on our stage, we find that it's not only our classical fans who are coming, it's the rock fans and the folk music fans and the old electric guitar players who have played in a band of their own. Guitar seems to just be a language that everyone understands.
Yeah, and I did want to ask you about the Joanne Folletta classical guitar competition.
Right.
What did you have a competition experience when you were young, when you were learning guitar?
Well, not really, because there really weren't any. But I was inspired by the Van Cliburn competition with pianists, and I thought, you know, if we could do something like that for guitar, we could make even more people love and hear the sound of a classical guitar. So we started the competition, and what we didn't realize is that guitar is popular all over the world. I mean, so we have so many foreign contestants. We bring 10 of them, the finalists, to Buffalo, from Japan, from Thailand, from South America, from so many different countries. And we have never had a U.S. winner. There have always been winners from all over the world. So, but that's a good thing in a way, you know, that we're bringing a lot of guitarists from everywhere to come to the United States to compete in this competition.
And then you personally, are you constantly learning new pieces on the guitar?
Well, I have to say, I mean, I confess to being somewhat lapsed as a guitarist. I mean, I do have my borrowed guitar here this week so I can keep on practicing. But I would say 90% of my time is conducting now. So, but the guitar still means a great deal to me, and it's very personal, so I don't think I will ever give it up.
Would you say it's a sort of a different, I don't want to say a different brain that you use to conduct or anything, but are you taking different inspirations when you're playing the guitar versus when you're conducting or listening to music?
It is different, because when I'm playing, I actually have to create the sound myself, as every musician does. And I think that's very important for me to do, because I have to keep in touch with that way of working, because that's how all of the musicians in the orchestra, they're touching a string and they're making sure that it's exactly in tune. The speed of their bow influences the sound, the vibrato that they use. So when I play the guitar, I'm thinking about those same things. And I think it keeps me in touch inside with what they do every day. So that's a good thing. And I think that the guitar has influenced my feeling of how to conduct too, because it teaches me how to accompany soloists well. It teaches me how to look for structure in music. So I think it's been a very important part of my life.
Yeah, and you must be, you know, completely well-equipped to translate the music into what sound you're making when you're playing the guitar, since you're intimately aware of everything. Yeah.
About sound and color, right? And I think that I use the word color, and some people say that's odd with music, but it does have a color or a timbre, as sometimes we say in the French word, but But the high and oboe sounds different than a flute, or a cello sounds different than a viola. It's the color of it, and mixing those colors on the stage, so ear colors, that's what makes it a thrilling experience.
That's interesting. Do you have the synesthesia, maybe?
No, but that's a very, very rare gift where people actually, synesthesia actually, see colors when they hear certain pitches. Yeah. That's just amazing. Can you imagine that? I've known a couple of people who have that gift, and to them it's completely natural. They think everybody does just see things in colors.
Yeah. I just wonder, if you can harness that.
Yeah. I don't know.
It's fascinating. That's great. Well, are there any composers or any new sort of trends in classical music that you're looking to now, sort of that you're following?
Well, it's been wonderful. The last 20 years, 10 years in classical music has been wonderful in that music has been going in so many different directions. There's not one way to compose new music now. It can be neo-romantic, it can be impressionistic, it can be minimalist, it can be world music where people are taking inspiration from Asia or South America. Look at all of the sort of tango rhythms that we now hear in music. People are writing in a very different way. And I think that's opened up our palette in the orchestra to grow in our time. As an orchestra, we're a museum in a way because we present all of these wonderful treasures of the past. And that's good. I mean, we want to take care of those and always have them available and play them for the audience. But we're really a 21st century organization now, and we should be playing music that's a mirror of our time. That will keep us valid and growing. So it's exciting to see so many people like Jen Higdon exploring different ways of writing music and have it reach the public, have it communicate to 21st century listeners.
And then are there conductors or orchestras that are doing good things that you are watching?
I'm always on the internet trying to find out what program someone did or how the critic thought about this new piece, because it's interesting. It doesn't really mean that's only one person's opinion, maybe, but it does keep you in touch with lots of different trends. And I think the trends are to incorporate now more music by women, which is wonderful, and to incorporate more world music, so that diversity is very important. And that's giving a sort of a new, fresh life to our orchestras. So I think it's an exciting time for orchestras.
What advice would you give to women or, people who might not be normally from the traditional,
right,
symphony going background? What advice would you give to them to either be a part of music or just to listen to it?
Now is the time. I think the door is really opening up for women. That's not to say that a career in music is easy, and I think probably every musician in the Arkansas Symphony would say the same thing. A career in music requires total dedication, really all your life. It's not a 9-to-5 job. It's a job that requires growing all the time and practicing all the time and learning all the time. For me, that's a wonderful approach to life, to be on a journey and never reaching the end, never reaching a point where you say, well, now I know. You don't. You just keep developing. But it is a time when women now have, I think, doors opening for them that they maybe didn't have in the past. So I would say go for it and be prepared for a challenging, wonderful, unique life that you'll be in the middle of music.
That was Joanne Folletta, music director of the Buffalo Philharmonic Orchestra and the Virginia Symphony. She'll launch the Arkansas Symphony Orchestra's 2019-2020 season with Ravel's Valse, Rimsky-Korsakov's Scheherazade, and the Time for Three Trio's rendition of Concerto 4-3 by former Arkansas Symphony Composer of the Year Jennifer Higdon. The concerts are on Saturday, September the 28th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, September 29th at 3 p.m.
And that concludes the program for this week. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UA Little Rock Public Radio.